Horror, ein Filmgenre, das durch Schockmomente und Gänsehautfaktor besticht. Seit Jahrzehnten begeistern Gruselfilme ein großes Publikum und sorgen für zahlreiche Fortsetzungen und Neuverfilmungen. Doch was steckt hinter dem Anreiz, sich beim Anschauen von Filmen und Serien zu gruseln? Und welchen Mehrwert hat das Ganze? Über all das und vieles mehr haben wir uns mit Vic Garris unterhalten, einem amerikanischen Regisseur und Drehbuchautor.
Der Schauerfaktor zieht sich durch Micks gesamte Filmografie. Er hat seine Karriere in den 1980ern begonnen mit Horrorfilmen für ein jugendliches Publikum. Später kamen mehrere Zusammenarbeiten mit Stephen King durch dessen Buchverfilmungen zustande und zahlreiche weitere gruselige Geschichten in Film und Fernsehen. Außerdem ist er bekannt durch seinen Interview-Podcast Postmortem with Mick Garris.
Im Anschluss an das Gespräch mit ihm hört ihr noch unser Fazit. Bleibt dran und viel Spaß!
Great. So we are going to start off with a question about your work in general. You have several credits as a screenwriter and as a director, or both on the same project. Which of these filmmaking aspects do you prefer? And what are the pros and cons between working in TV versus working in film? Obviously, you've got a lot of experience in both.
Okay, those are two big questions. I love them both. And for entirely different reasons. Writing is a very onanistic process. It's very isolated. But you're entirely in control of everything. There are no considerations as to ego, as to complexity, as to losing the daylight or all that. And I really like that creative time that's entirely by myself, where you're creating worlds and all it is the creative process. But directing, you don't get hired as a director until they're ready to make the movie or TV show. And that's a big step because most of the things a screenwriter writes never gets made. But in this case, once you're allowed to direct, then you know it's going to be made. But also you get to work with dozens, if not hundreds, of really talented artists and artisans. I mean, actors and composers and camera people and crew people, all of them bringing their talents and enthusiasm into creating the vision that everyone is agreed upon. And being in that social situation, I'm really good at being by myself. But I really enjoy being socially involved as well with a group of other people when we're all united in a process. So the difference between making television and making movies has gotten smaller and smaller over the years. Television has gotten more cinematic and theatrical films have gotten more like series, expensive series, but like the Marvel Universe is like watching a group of TV series based on the same characters. And dramatic stories now have migrated to television where more serious work is found on television than it is in the cinemas. So the process is very much the same. Usually television is a lot less money. And if you're talking about series television, that's one thing, but making television movies or miniseries, you have to think about the advertisers. You have to think about where the commercial breaks go, if indeed you're not doing it for a streaming or a pay cable company. You know, HBO or Netflix, you don't have to worry about that. It's the identical process as to making a movie. But for commercial television, the process is different in that there are a lot more cooks involved. Not only are there studio executives and producers and the like, but there are advertisers as well that have some say. Less say than they used to, because commercial television sponsored by advertising has shrunk. It's not nearly as important as what most people watch on television anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you did a lot of different things, but all of your work has one thing in common. It's mostly located within the horror genre. So what does draw you personally into that specific genre?
Well, I've always been into it. I think a lot of both fans and creators in the genre were outsiders when they were growing up. They were not the popular kids in school. they were not the ones playing sports with everybody on the team and the hail fellow well met. But they were more internal. I know my life was more internal than external. I spent a lot of time, even from the time I was 12 years old, I was writing stories and I was watching spooky movies from the time I was, you know, first saw Frankenstein and Dracula on television at the age of maybe 6 or 7. And it connected with me because I've always felt like an outsider. Even today, I feel that way. You know, when you're a member of the horror genre and making horror movies for television or theaters, you don't get respect unless you make a lot of money. The horror genre is a gutter genre. People think of it as a lower genre because it deals with our more baser instincts. It deals with the blood and guts and viscera that make up these physical bodies that are rent horribly. And, you know, we fear our bodies failing us or being failed by those who would do us physical harm. So I think it's an outsider thing. And then once you have any success in the genre, that's pretty much all you're allowed to do. You're in horror jail. Now, I love horror jail, so I don't consider it a prison. But being an opportunity to be known as a filmmaker within a genre is something I think to be proud of. You know, years ago, I interviewed Christopher Lee, and he hated the fact that his main claim to fame was Dracula. He would talk about all the other movies he made and the other parts he played, and those parts would never have been offered to him without his success as Dracula. So I have just learned to be very grateful every day that I've been able to carve a niche in the film world. And I love the horror genre. I would love to work outside of it, and I have once or twice. But I'd rather be proud of and happy with the work within a genre that I care about deeply than resent not having other opportunities.
So talking about the horror genre and going a little further into the niche of it, we are actually preparing a couple of shows for a movie show every Thursday. And now we're going to talk a lot about remakes and adaptations and sequels. And that's something that I personally always found very interesting about the horror genre in general. And, you know, obviously some of the most famous horror classics like John Carpenter's The Thing or David Cronenberg's The Fly are remakes of older films. And yet the wave of horror remakes in the last 15 years or so hasn't been met with as much critical acclaim for various reasons, obviously. But in your mind, as an expert on this field in many ways, what is the key to a successful and good remake?
Well, the key to doing it well is bringing something new to it, making it modern, making it mean something, making it contemporary, but also making it a really good movie. In general, I'm no fan of sequels and remakes, but, you know, I'm biting the hand that fed me since I started with Critters 2 and Psycho 4 and The Fly 2 and things like that. But hopefully there's the opportunity, like you said, you gave two of the best examples. The Thing by John Carpenter is fantastic. The remake of The Thing after John Carpenter's was not so fantastic. The Fly was brilliant because they found a really adult take on that story that was old by the time they were making it. You know, the original Fly from the 1950s, 1954, I think, it was very much of its era. It's beautifully shot, beautifully made, but it was very dated. You can watch The Fly, Cronenberg's The Fly today, and it still has tremendous impact. And it's got an amazing emotional connection, an emotional love story at the heart of a really wonderful monster movie. So the deeper you feel these characters and identify with them, the greater the movie is. And so, you know, for me to be interested in seeing a remake in the first place, it's got to bring something to it. But if you're remaking something, you're remaking it because the original concept is so good. It's better to remake something that wasn't great in the first place than to try and remake a great movie and then fail at it.
That's true. I mean, obviously, the downside of that would be that a great movie would have name recognition. And that's obviously often the reason why it's getting remade or getting a sequel in the first place. But yeah, there are a lot of great examples in that. And I mean, one of the famous examples for that would be Gus Van Sant's Psycho remake, which is obviously a shot-for-shot remake. And since didn't add much to the original. And you already mentioned Psycho 4, which I actually just watched last Sunday. And in my opinion, I really liked it. And it's actually better than, and it has any right to be, with a title like Psycho 4 at the beginning.
That's exactly word for word what I tell people. It's better than it has any right to be with a number 4 in the title.
I personally totally agree. And obviously you directed that, stepped in the shoes of Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock, and you also did a Shining miniseries in the 90s, which was one of many Stephen King collaborations of yours. So what was important for you to do differently or keep from the originals? And how did you deal with criticism, maybe, with stepping in the shoes of such big directors as Stanley Kubrick and Alfred Hitchcock?
Because there's no way I'm standing in their shoes. They're great filmmakers. I'm somebody who does the best that I can with the opportunities I've given. In the case of Psycho 4, the script was written by Joseph Stefano, who wrote the original Psycho script. The producer, Hilton Green, was Alfred Hitchcock's first AD. Tony Perkins was the star. And Tony wanted to direct it, but he had directed Psycho 3, which was a total failure, critical and financial failure. So when they brought in the director of Critters 2 to direct Psycho 4, he tested me a lot. But having a passion for it, and this brought it up to date as well. You know, the people involved all thought that this was a story worth telling. And having Perkins there giving his all, having a cast like Olivia Hussey and Henry Thomas on board, gave it validity. And there was a reason to do the script. There was another step in the story of Norman Bates that was worth telling. Plus, I have to admit, it was early in my career, and it was an opportunity for me to do something for the cable channel Showtime, which was far smaller than HBO at the time. So if it was a success on Showtime, people would say, oh, did you see Psycho 4? It's great. And if it was not, then nobody would know, because not that many people had Showtime. But in the case of The Shining, that was really different, because it's well known that Stephen King never liked the Kubrick film. If you saw the Kubrick film first, you love the Kubrick film. But if you'd read King's The Shining, as I had, before seeing the Kubrick film, it broke my heart, because I loved the book so much. I thought it was one of the best, certainly the best horror novel I'd ever read, because of its depth of character and all of that. But the Kubrick film became iconic and a classic, and it is a great film. And it took me a while to realize that he didn't make a great Stephen King adaptation, but he made a great movie. You know, it's a great Stanley Kubrick film. But it was Stephen King who was not satisfied that after we had the great success with The Stand, which was the highest rated miniseries in U.S. television history, they asked King what he wanted to do next. And he said, I'd like to do The Shining. I don't think it was done right, and I think it'd be great. And King himself wrote the script, adapted from his own novel, and chose me as the director. And so my commitment was to bringing everything that was great in the book to the screen, to make it as cinematic as possible, and to tell the story in a very humane way. I mean, the story of Stephen Weber's character of Jack Torrance is an incredibly emotional one. This is a story all about a guy who's feeling tremendous guilt for getting so drunk that he broke his little boy's arm. You know, it's a very emotional story. And Kubrick's style is very clinical and not as deeply humanistic, at least in the case of The Shining. I mean, he's a great filmmaker, and his movie is a great movie. But as an adaptation of the warm side of Stephen King, who's very much about the complexity of humanity, it wasn't a perfect match. It made for a great book, and it made for a great Kubrick film. And my job was to try and make a hybrid of them and try to make a great miniseries that reflected what everything that was good about the book.
You already mentioned sequels and that you're not the biggest fan of them, but now this year there is a sequel coming out, and I think you might know what I'm talking about, of a film that you actually worked on, of Hocus Pocus.
Yes.
And I mean, you're not involved in the sequel, but how do you feel about it, that a film that you worked on, you wrote the screenplay for it, is now getting a sequel?
It's pretty amazing what has happened with Hocus Pocus, because it was not particularly successful when it came out. But after it started to appear on the Disney Channel, like 10 years after the movie was released, and I wrote my script 8 years before the first movie was made. So it took years for it to be successful and popular on television. And then every year it grew and grew and grew. And now it's bigger than ever. The biggest Halloween movie ever, the most merchandised movie out there besides Star Wars, I think. And it has become a perennial classic. And that's something that you rarely get to experience. A screenwriter or a filmmaker rarely gets a chance to do something that connects with the public in such a way that it becomes iconic. So that alone is more than enough for me. Knowing that there is a sequel that has been made and it'll be out in October is pretty exciting. I have no idea how it's going to be. You know, I hope for the best and I'm excited. It's from another perspective and it's a female writer and director. I'm excited to see what comes of it.
Yeah, me too. I'm actually a huge fan. It's one of my top 1 Halloween movies to watch each year.
Thank you. It's so weird to go out on Halloween and see dozens of little girls wearing Sanderson sisters costumes and Billy Butchers and things like that.
I think that's also a really cool thing, that in the sequel, they're actually the original Sanderson actresses are returning to play the
sisters. That wasn't originally the plan. They were going to make it with new young sisters. And it was like, I don't think that's the right idea. So they finally got around to doing it right and bringing back the 3 originals. And that's exciting.
You already also mentioned that you're open to try something other than horror, or if you would consider to go back or do films like Hocus Pocus, which are targeted more at a younger audience, or if you prefer to focus on horror, which is more targeted at adults.
Well, a lot of my early career was more youth-oriented. Films like Batteries Not Included, which I wrote, and Critters 2 is a little older kids, but Hocus Pocus, Working on Amazing Stories, that was mostly a very family-oriented thing. But I've always been interested in darker material, as well as the more lighthearted stuff. But as I've matured over the years, I've gotten more interested in going into deeper and more adult themes, partly by working with Stephen King and Clive Barker and people like that. You know, my books that I've written are much darker than a lot of the films that I've done. Masters of Horror was the opportunity to do uncensored horror and give all these great filmmakers the opportunity to do that. I would love to do, you know, something along the lines of my books. I wrote a book called Salome that is a Hollywood desert noir murder mystery. And I'd love to make that into a movie. I'd love to do something in the crime noir sort of field, or a complex erotic thriller or something, or a courtroom story. You know, I did two-part miniseries called The Judge, and I had a blast. I love courtroom dramas, and I really had a good time doing that. Western, maybe not, but but yeah, I'd love to try something. And I'd love to do something in the comedic realm. You know, the only real comedy I've done, Hocus Pocus, is kind of a comedy, but I didn't direct it. I would say it's a comedy. But Critters 2 is probably more comedy than horror. And it's been revived a lot lately. And I see it and I say, you know, I'd like to do that again.
And since you already mentioned Masters of Horror, I haven't managed to watch that many of the episodes. They aren't as easily available in Europe. But the ones I did see, it felt to me that this was a precursor to what you're kind of seeing now with streaming, with services like Shudder or even Netflix and Amazon, who are doing their own anthology series, especially within genres, be it horror or science fiction or fantasy. So were there ever talks of doing Masters of Horror on streaming, or did you feel like you were doing kind of the first step to do that before it actually became not as niche as it is as it was back then?
Well, it was very groundbreaking because it was for Showtime. It wasn't for commercial television. And then around the world, various different broadcasters aired it. It's actually the best versions of it around are German Blu-rays. They made a great couple of sets. You know, I have this gravestone. It's a plastic gravestone that has all of the 26 episodes in it, and it's a German import. And there's another one that, like Sleepwalkers, is the head of Charles Brady with the Blu-ray inside it. And they're beautiful editions, but I guess they're out of print now. We thought it would be a difficult sell, but it was just get the best people making horror movies in the world and let them do what they want. Yeah, there's not going to be as much money. There's not going to be as much time. But creative control is something that we rarely are able to get. And it was groundbreaking in that we were able to do uncensored horror stories for television. And yeah, it definitely inspired the idea of anthological horror on the streamers. It's just that there weren't streamers yet in 2005 when we did it. It's a good place for anthology to live is on streamers because you can watch one of them anytime. In an anthology, they're not necessarily connected. A series like American Horror Story is one story over the course of a season, and then the next season is an entirely new story and all that. But I love the idea of a new movie every time you watch, and especially by these great filmmakers. And, you know, a lot of people complain that we didn't do more than two seasons. I'd rather celebrate two seasons of great shows than bemoan what might have been a third or fourth or fifth season that went on longer than it should have. So, you know, there are shows that go for 7 years and the last three or four kind of, you know, maybe you should have given up when it was at your strength rather than at your weakness.
Also, you mentioned the other filmmakers you've worked with and are acquainted with. So let's talk a bit about Postmortem with Mick Garris, a talk show and later a podcast, still a podcast, where you chat with fellow horror filmmakers and even interact with fans. So what was the motivation behind creating that show in the first place?
Well, I've always been an interviewer. When I was in high school, I interviewed Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and published my own little magazine at the age of 18 called Arthur the Magazine. I wrote for underground newspapers and things like that, which don't really exist anymore. But it was always out of curiosity. The first guy I ever interviewed was Ray Bradbury, who was my favorite author when I was 12 years old and on. I just learned so much. I'm a sponge around people who inspire me. The second interview I did was with Rod Serling, who created and ran The Twilight Zone, the original. And these people inspire me a lot. And even when I was doing music journalism, I was a musician in a band, a singer in a band at the time, and just getting to talk to people who I admired and asking them questions. And it just felt really personal and the like. And I figure if I'm interested in something somebody has to say, there's an audience that's interested as well. So I started doing TV interviews on the Z Channel, which was a local LA pay TV channel here in California. And we would do a 15-minute interview before they'd show the movie. So I would talk to Steven Spielberg and they'd show Close Encounters. I would talk to John Carpenter and they'd show Halloween. Talk to Joe Dante and they'd show Piranha. So a lot of those people became friends of mine. And the whole idea of doing interviews and learning from something, we had done those years and years ago. And then Peter Block at FearNet, which was an online TV network horror channel sponsored by Lionsgate, he came to me and asked me about doing an updated version. So we did the Postmortem TV show. We did 10 of those and we got all the greats and Toby Hooper and William Friedkin and all kinds of great people, Rick Baker. And so my producer Joe on the podcast was at a party with one of the people from Podcast One, which is the biggest podcast network in the world. And he was talking to them about, what do you think about a podcast version of Postmortem? And I didn't know anything about it. And so they called me into a meeting they were kind of pitching their company to me. And it was great. They said, and you know, people make up to $7.5 million a year doing the podcast. And I got, yeah, right. So we did it. And Rob Zombie was our first guest. And we found that I had access to people who were willing to have conversations with me and get together and just talk. And it was filmmaker to filmmaker rather than journalist or podcaster to filmmaker. And people felt really comfortable. And again, we've done well over 100 interviews now. And I swear I've learned something from every single one of them. I'm fascinated. I'm curious. And I figure if I am, there are other people out there who are as well.
I think you also just mentioned two of the key aspects what people appreciate about you and your work, both in filmmaking-wise and with the Postmortem podcast, that you're keeping those community of horror directors together, like people like Joe Dante, that you're friends with in real life and still arrange meetings with them or reunion episodes, and also the fan interactions. I personally remember when I was in high school or something and the podcast was still a talk show on YouTube and you even responded to one of my comments there. So,
oh, good.
that's probably still something that keeps like a sentiment into the horror fans tend to have a tight community.
Well, and it's the only genre that does, you know, it's the only genre that has film festivals and magazines and anthologies and shows and all of that. And, you know, doing the Ask Mick Anything segments every other week on the podcast is really fun. But, you know, we are a community of outsiders. And although horror has become mainstream, These conventions and festivals around the world are a place where we can get together and share our passion for what other people consider to be beneath them. People who are into horror, I think, are, for the most part, not entirely, a lot better balanced. Certainly the people who make horror, they get their angst out. You know, I dream awake, so my nightmares are on the screen, and I don't remember dreaming much at all in real life. And I think it's probably because of the stories that I'm lucky enough to tell.
The podcast, I think, is also a really good example how you can still work during a pandemic, because it's easily manageable with social distancing. But how has working in the American film industry changed during the past 2 years, and how has it impacted your own work?
Well, it has changed a lot. A lot of things that we're going forward kind of hit the skids. And there's also a big change overall going on, where different genders and different ethnicities and the like are given opportunities that they weren't given before. And I think that's a really great and healthy thing. You know, I'm lucky enough to keep working or to work or not work if I so choose. And at this point, Clive Barker and I are working on a pilot. We're writing a pilot together for an anthology series of all original stories from Clive. And so that's what I was working on when I missed by 8 minutes our planned meeting here. So I've got a couple of movies in development. There's one that's an African-American story that I want a Black director to do, certainly not myself. And so I'm having more fun writing right now and not directing as much, although when the right project comes along, or if I create the right project that I think is something personal, then I certainly will jump back into that chair. But right now I'm having a good time writing screenplays as well as fiction. You know, I've had a few books come out as well, and that's been a really exciting part of my life too, even though, you know, they're not bestsellers and certainly not going to make my living from the novels. Not many people do these days, except for the huge bestsellers. But I've got books on the shelf that I wrote.
Das war unser Interview mit Mick Garris. Wir hoffen, ihr konntet einige informative Fakten über seine Arbeit und das Horrorgenre mitnehmen. Neben seiner Filmkarriere fanden wir auch die Einblicke in sein frühes und aktuelles journalistisches Schaffen interessant.
Wir bedanken uns bei Mick, dass er sich die Zeit genommen hat und hoffen, ihr schaltet bald wieder ein bei Radioaktiv. Das waren für euch in den Mikros Lea
und Patrick.